Hey, my name is Braden, one of the servant leaders here at Ethos. Thank you so much for checking out our podcast today. We hope you can lean in and enjoy this message.
I'm really especially excited to jump into this kind of overview of the book of Colossians. And Pastor Jordan just does such a good job summarizing. But one of the things I was, when we were watching the announcements, that I just kind of choked up a little bit and got so overwhelmed is how much work you guys as a church do in our city. That is just, it blew my mind. I mean, with the Bloom store, with Out of Darkness, and just all the different things that the Pregnancy Resource Center, like all the things that you guys are investing in this city is just absolutely mind-blowing. And I just wanted to start and say thank you for that. One of my roles in the city, I get to serve as the executive director of this ministry called For Columbus, and it does a lot of work to unite churches and help them do collaboration with nonprofits and business leaders around the city. And you guys are like the beacon, the example that just makes me so thankful and proud. And so I just wanted to start and say thank you as we jump into this book, Colossians. So I'll start by telling you a quick story. In 2016, I got to take this sabbatical. When I was pastoring a church, I got to take the sabbatical out to the Rocky Mountains. I spent 7 weeks in the Rocky Mountains. I know you're super jealous. But I did, and it was awesome. But one of my favorite activities to do out there is mountain biking. And after a few weeks of getting my feet under me in terms of mountain biking, you know, this Ohio guy had it took me a while to get kind of used to the Rocky Mountain type of mountain biking. But I was feeling a little bit overconfident, and I was feeling a little cocky. And I was like, there was this one trail that I really, really wanted to accomplish when I was out there. It was a 30-mile trail, which in mountain biking terms is just like 7,000 miles. But it was also a double black diamond trail. And, you know, for me and my skills, and I'm not very good at mountain biking, I was way overconfident, and it was just ridiculous how much excitement I brought into that. But I had my wife drop me off. She was very reluctant, but she drops me off at the trailhead, and she agrees to pick me up in 4 hours at the other end of the mountain. And she was a bit nervous about that, and she should have been, because the first 12 miles of this trail were literally uphill. Like, I shouldn't say uphill, up mountain. I mean, it was straight up this mountain. I could barely walk my bike. There was times where I was sitting on my butt, just dragging my bike and trying to push myself up the mountain. And I had no cell service. My wife had left, so she was at the other side. So I had no choice but to keep going. And of course, about halfway up the mountain, the wind starts picking up intensely. And of course, it was coming right down and just pushing me down the mountain. Huge gusts of wind were pushing me, and I'm completely overwhelmed, wondering why I'd actually decided to do this. But I was committed. I had no choice. So I'm dragging my bike up. I'm out of breath. I'm sweating, yet I'm freezing at the same exact time. And then of course, it decides that it's time to hail. And I'm basically, you know, I don't know if I'm turning in a man card here, but I almost want to start crying. Okay, maybe I was crying a little bit. But I had my helmet on, so we were good, right? Hail is fine. You know, I climb under a pine tree with my bike, and I got some really great video of the hail for my kids so they could see how amazing I was at this, even though I was crying like a baby under this tree. But these giant hail, like they're the size of golf balls, come falling down, and I'm still crawling and getting my bike up to the top. But finally, after like 4 hours, I get to the top. The hail had stopped, the wind had slowed down a little bit, the storm had passed. And as I'm on top of the mountain, this particular mountain, there is literally no soul around. This is not the kind of mountain you drive up to, or there's a trail that people hike up to. I'm completely alone and just surrounded by absolute beauty. And it was just, it was undescribable how quiet it was and the bigness of creation and the smallness of me. I actually got a picture. I don't know if you can pull this picture. This is a terrible picture. I mean, it just doesn't even do justice. I'll blame it on the screen and my terrible camera work. But I wanted to prove to you that I actually did this. This isn't like a preacher story. I'm up at the top, and I'm looking at all this beauty, and I'm thinking, why do we risk so much in our lives to see such beauty? Why do we are willing to go through so much pain to see these beauty? Some of you are like, well, I just drive up. It's no big deal. You know, you can drive up to a, you don't need to go through all that. But some of us really like that. You know, we're a sucker for that. And I think, I'm not trying to be controversial here, but I think hiking up and climbing up and mountain biking up are just so much better than driving up the side of a mountain just to be able to see and take in the beauty. But why do we like this? Why do we like hiking up these mountains? Why do we love soaking in such beauty and majesty? We get to those places and those spaces where we just feel so small. And we look and we see such bigness. I mean, even when we were singing the songs, did you see what was in the background? All these mountains. I mean, can you imagine us singing these worship songs and it's just like cornfields? We'd be like, you know? That doesn't do it. The mountains, though, they bring it. They make us feel so small, and they make us want to behold something so big. Well, the book of Colossians is Paul's way of bringing us a mountain. The mountain. The mountain of mountains. To this space where we're in this awe moment, where we're seeing the beauty and the splendor and the supremacy and the power of God before us. He wants us to take us into that spot that he's like, you know, the mountains, the Rocky Mountains, they're great, but I want to show you something even better, something even bigger. It's a book that paints God in all his majesty and all his glory and all his power and all his height and his depth. It's a book that lets God be God. Some of us have a lot of real pain going on in our lives. We have some bills that we're struggling to pay, maybe kids that are not making decisions that we would like them to be making, marriages that feel like they're crumbling and struggling, jobs that leave us wondering, is this it? Is this what my life is about now? I mean, we read the news and we were praying for this, praying for Israel, and we're remembering Ukraine and the political fighting that's going on here. There is so much that feels so out of our control, so much chaos in the world, so much chaos in us. So we all need this moment to step back and just be in awe of something bigger than us. So what I want to do today, is twofold. I'm going to give some backdrop to this letter that will set you up for the rest of the series in this book and hopefully make the devotional that you get, make that devotional more rich to engage with. But I also want us to sit at the mountain of God. I also want us to be able to have a moment this morning of awe and splendor and sitting and beholding the glory of Jesus. To see God as God. So let's start with some context. Paul, the apostle, and the author of the book of Colossians is writing these words from prison. He was in prison between 60 and 61 AD in Rome. And you can read more about this in Acts chapter 28, going back there and seeing how that unfolded. But we have to understand that Paul is not writing this in some air-conditioned church office. He is writing this under the weight of oppression and for preaching the gospel, where he was mocked and beaten and arrested for preaching the gospel, for making Jesus known. This is not him writing these big, glorious things in comfort. So as Paul was struck, imprisoned, and he heard about the struggles going on in the churches, places like Ephesus and Colossae. He took advantage of this time when he was in prison, and he wrote these letters with a vision to strengthen the church. Paul was always interested in strengthening and encouraging and coming alongside the church, even though in this particular church, he has not even met most of the people here. He doesn't even really know them. He was friends with Epaphras, who was, that's a great name if you're thinking of naming a kid, Epaphras. He planted this church in Colossae. So he was the main pastor, the church planter. He planted this about 5 years ago. So that's the same age as Ethos, right? So you can imagine kind of where this church is similar place as where the church in Colossae was. So in Paul and Epaphras, they were friends. And Epaphras himself, he knew what was going on in the church and what the church was going through. He knew the temptations that many people faced. He knew firsthand of all the false teachings that were circulating around the city. So he fills Paul in. He lets Paul know what's going on. And Paul decides then, I'm going to write a letter to encourage and strengthen the church into a better direction, because Paul still was a very spiritually influential leader throughout the church, and Epaphras would have loved him to speak into this. So Paul starts this letter with two prayers. First, he was thankful that they were faithful to Jesus Christ. And I think it's important to remember that he recognized that they were still very faithful to Jesus. Even though there were some issues going on in the church, they were still faithful to him. He knows there's a lot of temptation to go another way, especially as the false teachers come in. So he's thankful for that. And then secondly, he prays that they would grow in wisdom. That they, again, they faced a lot of these issues and they needed a spirit-filled wisdom to navigate some of the issues going on. So you see, this church was unique. And a lot of the first century church was very, very unique. And I really think we need to understand this to understand the entire New Testament, but especially this book. Because the church was made up of Gentile Christians and Jewish Christians. Now, like a lot of the newly formed churches, this is a multi-ethnic foundation that the church was living with. And this multi-ethnic church, the life together, it could be very tricky. It can be super challenging to know, how do we live together? How do we be in community with one another with very different backgrounds? And so it was easy for the church to say, you know what, we're going to just divide this thing up. The Jewish church and the Gentile church, we'll just divide or split it up. You know, you guys over here, you guys over here, you do your thing, you do your thing. That would be a lot easier for them. But no, they were mixed up and they were forming this new community. And so because they were forming this new community with all these different backgrounds, it just created a lot of tension and a lot of problem. But here's the thing, is the first century church was always willing to stay and work through it. They didn't just split it up. They didn't just start church for Gentiles over here, church for Jews over here. No, they like said, we're committed. We're going to work it out. We're going to talk it out. We're going to work this oneness out. It was not an option for them to divide. Let me unpack this a little more. You had Gentiles who have this whole history of many gods to worship, what is called polytheism, meaning you can imagine they line up these different gods for different occasions and different things. And so it was tempting when Paul would roll in or another Christian would roll in just to say, okay, why don't you add Jesus to the list of all these people? You know, you got your mantle, this God for this, this God for this, this God for this. Just add Jesus in there. That would be tempting for them. But what we're seeing is the church is saying, no, Jesus is not just another add-on to that. He is supreme over all of those so-called gods. He is over all of those different philosophies. He's over all the various wisdoms of the age. So Epaphras, he would have realized this, and he would be preaching to this regularly. He would be speaking, Jesus is over all of these things, all of these gods, all of these philosophies, all of these wisdoms. But there was this other group, the Jewish Christians, nations who, of course, had one God, and they had the Old Testament, but carried a load of traditions and rites and rituals that would have been incredibly tangled up, and it'd be hard to really get to Christ because they had so many rituals and things they had to go through. They would have missed out on the mercy and the grace and the love of Christ and all of that. So in the middle of these two backgrounds going on in the church, what we can kind of understand is there was some false teachers that came in, and they were proposing a new kind of wisdom. What scholars call the Colossae heresy. Like, it's literally what they're calling it. It's a claim that they had some higher knowledge of God that they could get from communion, mystical communion with the angels. Very strange. I know it's very strange for us. But the Gentiles loved this idea and this philosophy because it imparted wisdom. Gentiles loved wisdom. They in fact, worshiped and pursued wisdom. And the Jews loved this because angels were a very big part of creation. But Epaphras and Paul, they know that the profound work of the gospel is not found in some communion with angels, but it can be fully found in communion with Jesus, going to him. So since the beginning of the church, humanity has always drifted into lanes and pathways that we think are going to bring us new wisdom. We've always gone in some direction or another. Somebody comes along and says, I've got a new wisdom. I've got a new idea. We've always sought to build plastic mountains where we can have that awe experience. We can feel a greater power around us while we're actually missing out on the real mountain. And where this heresy of the first century church, again, it might be a little weird for us because we're, you know, they're talking about communion with the angels, and it might be weird for us modern Christians. Let me ask, what do you think that looks like in Central Ohio today? What would you say is the Columbus heresy? If Paul was writing to us, what would be the Columbus heresy? Now, I think about this a lot because it's kind of my job, and I'm very passionate about working with other pastors and church leaders all over Ohio, and I'm always thinking, what is it that keeps us all from really experiencing the glory and supremacy of Jesus Christ in all things? What is it? What is the heresy of our day? And I know heresy, that's a big word. That's something we should not use lightly. That's a very, very big and heavy word. But what is it? What is it that we struggle with in our day? Maybe it's the culture wars that we're tangled up in, where we're just obsessed with changing the culture. Or maybe it's our obsession with entertaining religious people, like creating a cheap consumer Christianity instead of being effective disciple makers of Jesus. Maybe it's our complacency and our inaction towards the marginalized in our city that robs Christianity of any power and any authority and any relevancy in this world. What is our heresy? I'm just going to leave that to you to think about and reflect on. This backdrop is important because Paul, he doesn't spend a lot on the background because everybody in there would have already understood the background. So what he does actually spend a lot of time in is the solution. The real stuff. The real mountain. He's going to show us and take us to the real mountain. And that is beholding the beauty and the power and the glory and the sufficiency and the fullness of Jesus. So let's just go there. And I know you're going to spend a lot of time over the next few weeks going through more of that, but I want us to at least get an intro, get a feel into this place. So New Testament scholar Larry Hurtado tells us that the key theme throughout Colossians is the centrality and the supremacy of Jesus. I mean, you're a Bible underliner, or maybe I'll just challenge you to this, when you're going through the devotions, the devotional book, become obsessed with this one word, all. All. It's all over. And it's all over the place because there's so much power in that word all. It's all over to show us the supremacy that is wrapped up in Jesus. But this is how Paul kicks off this vision of Christ when he writes, this is verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of or over all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile him to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. Listen, let's open this up a little bit. You and I spend probably, if we're willing to admit it, too much time numbing ourselves, right? We do that through scrolling, you know, endless, mindless scrolling, doom scrolling, Netflix, sports. But there always comes a time, and I've been a pastor long enough to know that this is true. It's true in my own life. There always comes a time when we just hit that wall. When that numbing doesn't work anymore. Right? The big identity stuff catches up in us. We hit the wall, life crushes us, and we don't know what to do anymore. It doesn't work anymore. So that might happen if we lose a loved one. That might happen if we have a financial meltdown, a breakup, or just simply too much pressure on our lives to know how to keep moving forward, and the numbing won't work anymore. So that gives us space to get to the real question, the real big questions in us. Who am I? Really, who am I? And what's my purpose? Is there more to this? Well, Paul wants to answer that question. He wants to answer those deep questions. In fact, Paul wants to blow your mind by stating with a clear vision of the founder and the creator of you and I, showing us who is out there, who is giving us purpose, why he created us, who we are in light of who he is. So Paul brings some big words in this. Words that you and I probably don't use very often. But he brings these big words with the fullest of hope so that we can have that awe moment, that mind-blowing mountaintop moment that changes our lives, that changes our perspective, that lets us see Jesus as supreme and as God. So let's look quickly at these three parts. He says, Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for by him all things were created. So when we look out in our world, we can know that not anything out there, no microbe, cloud, fish, tree, single human being that exists out there has not been, it's all been created by Jesus. It doesn't just happen by accident. He's saying it has been created by God. Just stop and think about that. So after Jesus' death and his resurrection, when the disciples saw him in Matthew chapter 28, verse 17, see that they fell down and they worshiped him. They worshiped him. They worshiped him because they began to see this is not just a mere teacher. This is not just a guy with good values that just really nudges society in a better direction, but they began to see he is actually over all of creation. the King and Lord and the Almighty God. See, God is not seen. He is invisible. So Jesus, he incarnates. That's a big word. I know it's a big Christian word. He incarnates, which means in all his glory, in all his splendor, he put on flesh and became like us in flesh and blood. So that Jesus says to Philip in John 14, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. So all that is to say, there is this moment for the disciples where they finally see Jesus as who he really is. This is not just the guy that's been hanging out and camping out with us and traveling, letting us travel with him all around and good teachings and all that. It became this mind-blowing moment of he created me. Now, some of the people in Colossae, they actually may have been one of these people. They actually, they still might be alive and have actually seen. There might be that old woman sitting on her porch saying, I actually saw him rise from the dead. And for them, there was this moment of like, this is life-changing. He is over all creation. That he is over everything. So we have to stop and stand there, just realizing Jesus made me. He made all of creation. The second thing is that Jesus is holding all things together. He brings into being and he holds everything that is in being. Why do you think it is that we on this planet, I mean, just think about this for just a second. We on this planet sit so closely to the sun, yet we don't get burned, yet we're far enough away from the sun where we do not freeze. Why do we still see the sunrise and the sun fall? Why do we still see the flowers grow and the flowers fade? Why do we just have just enough gravity that we can walk around and run and do all kinds of things, but not so we don't just float off into space? Paul is telling us, Paul is actually singing this. Some say this is a hymn, this is a song. He's showing us it is Jesus' work, Jesus Christ at work, holding it all together. There is a power beyond our comprehension holding our planet where it needs to be in perfect harmony and holding us up where we need to be. And Paul is saying and singing, it is Jesus that is at work. He is doing this. Now, to a degree, many of us might understand that Jesus is in us, that he is in all things. We might say, yeah, I get all that. But we live like Jesus is up there, out there. He's out there kind of watching the weird human circus that's happening here in our lives. He's looking at that and just think, oh my gosh, I can't believe all this. But does it not amaze you that he is personally involved? He is involved in your pain, in your struggle, in your temptations, in your anxiety. He is involved with compassion and care. He's not just watching out there. He is right here in it. He is in the mix. Jesus is in all things, full of compassion for those who are suffering, full of justice for those who are inflicted and being taken advantage of, full of joy for those who can't even get out of the bed because there's just too much. It's just too much. Jesus is in it with us. Just as he perfectly holds earth close to the sun, he is holding us together. And this is big. This is big for those like me who have come to the end of myself and realize I can't hold it together. I can't even hold my family, myself together. This is the cue when I get to that end of myself, when I get to that place, this is my cue to look up and see in all his glory and greatness, and take a deep breath and know that Jesus Christ is holding it together. So Jesus is over all things. Jesus is in all things. And lastly, all things are for Jesus. All things were created through him and for him. What does it mean to be for him? Well, I'll tell you what it doesn't mean real quick. It's not like Jesus is like us, you know, where we're like, man, we have a void in our life, so let's go get a dog, right? The dog will make us happy, which never does. I have a dog and it doesn't work. He's not like God is up there pining and saying, I need something out there to make me feel a little bit happier or fulfilled. It's not like Acts 17:25 tells us God cannot be served as though he needed anything. So what does it mean to be for him, that he created us for him? Here's the simple idea. Many of you know this. You and I exist to show off God. Let me say that again, because we might know it up here, but I really want us to get it. You and I exist to show off God. God is so glorious, so big, greater than the Rocky Mountains, bigger than the sun and the galaxies, beyond, greater than anything. God is so glorious that he made you to show him off. Some of you are like, well, I'm just a nerdy accountant. Like, some of you are like, I just install drywall. Or how is that a reflection of God? He wants and sees all of those different things, those different callings, those different ways we work, those different ways our minds work, the different ways we do art, the different ways we do our work. He sees that. That's all a reflection of him, of who he is. Babies in the womb show off God's glory. Old women and men who are looking back and wishing they would have done more, God is saying, nope, I still made you to show my glory. So listen, who you are, your passions, your proclivities, your gifts, your talents, your quirks, your personality, that's one thing. But just you being you, you existing, you being created, all of that is to reflect his glory in some way, in some beauty. But hang on a second. I know we all have sin. We all have sin. We know that it's not reflecting very well. It's a dim and distorted kind of reflection, like a mirror that's just smudged all over and the glory of God doesn't quite come through. It looks a little rough. But here's the good news. If we go back to wrap all of this passage up, here's the good news, that Jesus is in and working that smudge as well. He has come to clean it. He has come and is coming to make all things new. He is restoring what was lost in us. He's taking that anger and that rage that we have for our kids, that we take out on our kids. He's saying to those who confess with their mouth and believe in their heart that Jesus is Lord, he is taking all of that and he is nailing it to the cross and he's pouring back out on it righteousness and glory. He is making us right. He is taking the porn addiction and he's commanding you to stop because it's destroying your reflector of God's glory. But he's also coming in and he is going to clean it for you. He's going to work it. He's going to wash it. He is going to clean you so that you can reflect him more and more and more as you go on in life. There's no purpose that we have that is in our career, no purpose of just being a better self or any of those kinds of things that we can look to that is going to give us both the purpose and the resources and the tools to shine us and to clean us and get us ready. It is all found in Jesus Christ. So do you see how big Jesus is here? What Paul is trying to show us, that he is over all things, in all things, that all things are for him, that we were meant to sit on the mountain of mountains and behold and stand in awe, be shocked and overwhelmed with this power of Jesus. So I want to conclude today, not with any application other than to behold. There's this interesting story in Numbers 21. This really odd story. Some of you might know this story. It's a very odd story. But all these poisonous snakes, it's always good when you start off with some poisonous snakes, right? All these poisonous snakes bite people because they were rebellious towards the Lord and they were rebellious towards this leader called Moses. And God told Moses to build the bronze snake and put it up on a pole. Some of you know this symbol. It's like on the side of a lot of ambulances. You'll see a pole with a snake wrapped around it. It comes from this story, actually. And he says that everybody that looks onto that pole will be healed. And all these people who had been bit by poisonous snakes were healed when they looked upon that pole. Now, like many of you, you are looking all over the place for what might heal you from life's pain. You've tried so many things to mend that wound or fill that emptiness. You've tried in career and relationships, taking that epic hike maybe. Paul is showing us, look to the cross of Christ. Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Look to the fullness of the unseen God found in Jesus Christ, not just today, but every day in our personal lives, in the life of the church, everywhere. It's Pastor Tim Keller, he reminds us this. He says, because the gospel is endlessly rich, it can handle being the burden of the main thing. Is Jesus Christ the main thing that you're looking to? The main thing that you're beholding? The main thing that you're in awe over? The comfort you look to in pain? The truth you look to in confusion? The place you dive deeper into knowing God? He is the central vision. Is he the central vision of your life? Is the cross the place that you're looking? The hope of God tells us in Isaiah 45, 22, turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. Look to him, turn to him. Let's pray.